Good afternoon. Today, the Security Council adopted a presidential statement on peace and security in Africa, expressing its concern about the situation in the Sahel region. Council members then adopted a resolution extending the mandate of the UNAU mission in Darfur, UNAMID, through June of 2015. Following that, they adopted a resolution modifying sanctions on Libya. Tarek Mitri, the Secretary General Special Representative in Libya, in his last briefing to the Security Council, said that since his briefing more than a month ago, conflict inflamed by airstrikes continues almost uninterrupted in Tripoli, Benghazi, and other parts of the country. He strongly condemned the recent indiscriminate shelling and said that those responsible for the loss of civilian lives must be held accountable. Mr. Mitri added that more than 100,000 people are estimated to be internally displaced, and at least 150,000 have fled the country. Many people in Libya are living in deteriorating conditions with limited access to food, fuel, water, and electricity. He said that the dialogue remains the only alternative to the prolonged violence and warned that the present political impasse will be deepened further by the use of force. He emphasized the UN's continuing role to spare no effort towards bringing the various parties to the dialogue table. His full remarks are available in my office, and we do expect him to speak to you at the Security Council stakeout as soon as he's done with the Security Council. Since early this morning, the UN Disengagement Observer Force, UNDOF, has observed heavy fighting between Syrian armed forces and armed members of the opposition in the area of Separation. During the fighting, several mortars landed in or near UN positions. The Israeli Defense Forces retaliated with fire. The UNDOF force commander remains in close contact with Syrian authorities and the IDF to urge restraint and to prevent an escalation of the situation. And from Gaza, for the first time since 2007, a World Food Program humanitarian convoy successfully crossed from Egypt into the Gaza Strip through the Rafah Gate. After a seven-hour drive from Alexandria across the Sinai Peninsula, the trucks carrying enough food to feed 150,000 people for 5 days arrived at the Rafah crossing. A second convoy is expected to cross into Gaza in the coming days. WFP says it is extremely important that it has access to the Gaza Strip from different routes to ensure constant flow of supplies to meet the growing needs of people affected by the violence. It also expressed its gratitude of the Egyptian government and for the opening of Rafah crossing and for allowing WFP to procure food in Egypt. Meanwhile, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports from Gaza that heavy movement of people and traffic was observed across the Strip today, with government and aid agency staff returning to their workplaces. Shops and markets were open. OCHA field officers are conducting assessment of displaced people. The number of displaced people, however, has already declined dramatically. The UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, reports that as of this morning, there were approximately 53,000 people staying in their shelters, and that's down from nearly 290,000 as of yesterday. UNRWA estimates that more than 100,000 displaced people will stay at UNRWA shelters because their homes have been destroyed. OCHA and Palestinian authorities are working together on a Gaza Early Recovery Reconstruction Plan, whose first phase will cover 100 days after the ceasefire. The ceasefire also enables the UN Mine Action Service to undertake risk assessment at UNRWA sites. Thousands of explosive remnants of war have been left in civilian areas impacted by the conflict. And as you will recall, yesterday afternoon, we issued a statement from the Secretary General welcoming the announcement of a ceasefire. From Afghanistan, in response to recent issues with the electoral audit process, the UN mission in that country has pledged today to redouble its support to the Afghan electoral authorities to help expedite the completion of a thorough and credible audit of the presidential runoff. The Secretary General, Deputy Special Representative for Afghanistan, Nicholas Haysom, who spoke to the media in Kabul earlier today, expressed the UN's regret at the decision of one of the presidential candidates, Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, to halt participation in the audit process. He added that the organization will continue to be actively engaged in dealing with the concerns about the audit process from both presidential candidates. In an effort to protect the integrity of the audit process, the UN has requested Dr. Ashraf Ghani's team to review their own participation. According to UN mission, after a pause in the morning audit, the audit resumed this afternoon in the presence of UN experts, representative of the Independent Election Commission, as well as international and national observers. And earlier today in Geneva, you will have seen that the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Syria issued its latest report, which says that mass atrocities by both government forces and non-state armed groups continue to take place in the country. According to the report, members of ISIL have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, including torture, murder, enforced disappearances, and forcible displacement. ISIL poses a clear and present danger to civilians and particularly minorities under its control in Syria and in the region. The report also noted that journalists and other media workers are systematically targeted. For its part, the government continues to commit violations, including war crimes and crimes against humanity, with impunity. Between January and July, hundreds of men, women, and children were killed every week by the government's indiscriminate firing of missiles and barrel bombs into civilian inhabited areas. There's clear evidence of some instances that civilian gatherings were deliberately targeted, constituting massacres. The report also says that in April and May, government forces used chemical agents, likely chlorine, in 8 separate incidents in western Syria. And the full report is online. Moving to Ukraine, the Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights, Ivan Simonovich, will begin a 7-day visit to Ukraine tomorrow. While in country, he will meet with Ukrainian officials and representatives of civil society and other groups. Mr. Simonovich will also travel to the east of the country to assess the human rights situation there. This will be his 4th visit to Ukraine since the beginning of the crisis earlier this year. And on Friday in Kiev, Mr. Simonovich will launch the 5th and latest report of the Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine. The report is expected to document grave human rights violations and abuses in eastern Ukraine and the impact of the intense, sustained fighting on the civilian population. Back here at headquarters, the Secretary General's Chef de Cabinet, Susana Malcora, addressed members of the global civil society at the opening of the 65th UN Department of Public Information NGO conference this morning. Ms. Malcora said the presence of the NGO community is crucial and timely as member states continue to negotiate the post-2015 development agenda, including climate change. She underscored the need to strengthen the UN's relationship with civil society, whose voices need to be heard more now than ever. The conference is titled 2015 and Beyond, Our Action Agenda, and that will go on till 29th of August. And her full remarks are in my office. And a couple of other notes from Iraq. The World Food Program says its food aid convoys have so far reached displaced Iraqis in Karbala, southwest of Baghdad. So far, more than 700,000 displaced people in Iraq have received food and assistance from WFP and partners since the start of the violence in mid-June. This week alone, 2,000 displaced families in Karbala received assistance after WFP sent convoys from Erbil. And we have more information available on WFP's website. And our colleagues in Mali report that this morning 8 rockets hit a UN peacekeeping camp in Agaloc in Mali Kidal's region. No casualties were reported. The Secretary General's special representative for Mali, Bert Conders, called for the attack cowardly and unjustified, adding that the goal of the UN mission, much like that of the people of the country, is the return of peace. He said the attack took place on the eve of the resumption of peace talks in Algiers, a crucial moment for the country's future. Mr. Conders called on strict observance of the ceasefire. And a note on Ebola, workshops organized by the World Health Organization aimed at strengthening preparedness and response against Ebola in West Africa began in the Republic of the Congo today. The workshops bring together more than 40 disease prevention and control officers, clinicians, and infection control officers and experts. And more is on the WHO's website. And lastly, I have a staffing announcement to announce a statement from the Secretary General on the appointment of Robert Orr as the Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a special advisor to the Secretary General on climate change. The Secretary General congratulates Robert Orr, Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Planning, on his appointment as Dean of the School of Public Policy of University of Maryland, starting in October 2014. The Secretary General expresses his deep gratitude for Mr. Orr's service and leadership over the past 10 years. Robert Orr has been instrumental in defining new roles for the United Nations and innovation strategies for addressing world problems on subjects as diverse as counterterrorism, human rights, peace building, women's and children's health, sustainable energy, institutional innovation, public-private partnerships, and climate change. Mr. Orr has forged the strategy and architecture for a 21st century United Nations. The Secretary General has asked Mr. Orr to continue to serve as a UN as a special advisor to the Secretary General on climate change to support efforts towards a universal climate agreement in 2015 and global climate action on the ground. He wishes Mr. Orr every success in his new role as Dean and looks forward to his continuing engagement with the United Nations on climate change. And tomorrow we will be joined by the UNDP's Deputy Director of the Bureau of Asia Pacific, Nicholas Rossellini, and Odo Tevi, the permanent representative of the Republic of Vanuatu to the United Nations. They will be here to present findings from a new UNDP report entitled The State of Human Development in the Pacific, a report on vulnerability and exclusion in a time of rapid change. And that comes just ahead of the meeting on the small islands developing states. That's it. Oleg.
Thank you, Stefan. Are there any updates with the investigation on the incident in the helicopter in South Sudan?
No, the an investigation to determine the circumstances of the crash, as you know, has been initiated. The Secretary General calls on all relevant authorities and parties to provide their full cooperation. He reminds them that he reminds all parties to respect the life-saving work of the UN personnel. And I would add that the Secretary General extends his heartfelt condolences to the bereaved families of the three crew members killed in the crash and to the government and the people of the Russian Federation. And the Secretary General wishes a full and speedy recovery to the fourth crew member who was, as you know, injured. Matthew and then Benny.
Yeah. Also on South Sudan, since you're on it, I know that the Secretary General issued a statement about the IGAD decision, but it seems that the main negotiator for the rebel side, Riek Machar and them, has said that they're not accepting it, that they believe that it imposes Salva Kiir as, quote, president for life, that it doesn't sufficiently address their concerns, that Salva Kiir would still be allowed to pick or not pick the prime minister. So I guess, does that statement still stand? I thought, from when I read it, I thought that it meant that the UN understood this to be agreed to, but it's not agreed to.
I have nothing to add to the statement. If I get new information from the reports you've stated, I will come back to you. Mr. Avni.
Okay, regrettably, I have three questions. First, on Afghanistan, is the recount, are there any the observers from Abdallah's side in the recount, in the resumed recount?
No, my understanding is that the resumed recount is being done in the presence of the Afghan experts, international observers, and UN experts.
What about Ghani?
No, it's my understanding that they're not present.
Neither Ghani nor
exactly.
Abdallah. Okay.
Exactly.
Secondly, on UNDOF, is there any plan for the force to relocate because the al-Nusra people and others have taken over the crossing in Quneitra, and also in the past there were, in cases like that, some contributors to UNDOF pulled out. Is the UN concerned that this will recur?
Well, we obviously, extremely value the commitments of troop contributing countries, and especially when they stay in times of crisis. In terms of relocation, none that I'm aware of. And at this point, we can't. You mentioned this gate, the so-called Bravo Gate. UNDOF is not in a position right now to confirm that this fighting is still ongoing at the Bravo Gate.
So it's in no position to confirm
that there is that this group has taken it over, as there's still fighting going on.
Okay, and the third is there are reports today that the agreement that was reached in Cairo included an increased role for SARI as a member of the group that oversees the entry of mm-hmm. of concrete and other stuff. Can you confirm it? Can you add some details as what those nudities?
No, I mean, obviously, I can't add any details at this point, but obviously, as the Secretary General has said and he's told his interlocutors in the region, the UN stands ready to help in the implementation of the ceasefire. Mr. Abadi.
Thank you, Stefan. Yesterday I asked you a question about the annual budget for preventive diplomacy, you asked me to look up the books.
I did,
with the assistance of the able assistance of the Doug Hammarskjöld Library staff. We could not put the figures together. Can you help?
I can help, but not at this very second. Karim.
On UNAMID, the UN the Security Council is renewing the mandate today. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know, after the ICC won the UN over UNAMID, you said that the Secretary General opened an internal investigation. We're still waiting for the result.
No, that is ongoing.
So when are we waiting
for? I can't give you an end date on it.
Because you said two weeks when the.
I don't believe I said 2 weeks, but we can always check what
so
I actually said.
So do we have a time frame?
No, I don't have a time frame to share with you at this point. Yes, and then we'll go to Errol.
Thank you. On Monday, I asked a question in regard to YS, and your answer was proved that the question was put very poorly. So if I may put it together again, the question.
Should I take that as a compliment?
Yes. Okay. YS... Prosecuting oppositions has been prosecuting those people have different religion than they believe, and they have no rights for females there, and they are grabbing lands. If you zoom out from there and look at the area altogether, you see that been practiced for many, many, many decades. And those countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Israel, Sudan, Egypt, and Syria, they are part of UN flags. And is it fair to say that situation right now, it's mainly because of the shortcoming of UN, they are not implementing human rights to the member states, they are not asking to honor the human rights? Thank you.
That's a very broad question. As I said yesterday, maybe best for a graduate school seminar. But I do believe that it is the responsibility of member states to live up to what is enshrined into the charter, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and to live up to the various treaties and protocols they have signed on to. The Secretary General has, I think, very clearly decried the abuses committed by ISIS and ISIL in the past, and he will continue to do so.
Sorry, but if they don't honor, isn't it UN responsibility to force them?
Because the UN stands, we the people, not the
government.
I completely understand, and I think everyone in the system, from the Secretary General to the Member States, the Security Council, has a role to play. Errol.
Thank you, Steph. Two short questions. First, tomorrow, the President of Turkey, the new President of Turkey, will be inaugurated, Mr. Tayyip Erdogan, and I confess that I'm not a very good student of protocol, but still, is anybody going to talk to him? Probably Secretary General will talk to him, or he sent his
Secretary
good
General
wishes.
Has already spoken to President-elect Erdogan to congratulate him on his election, and said he was looking forward to continuing to work with him on a number of issues ongoing in the Middle East, as well as the talks on Cyprus. He was also very pleased to hear that President Erdogan was expected at the climate change summit. I do believe there will be UN representation at the inauguration. I will try to get you that name and the level of that person.
And another one, can I go on?
Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
Short one on the renovation progress, how it's going. Do you expect that everything is going to be time? I'm talking about General Assembly Hall, everything is going to be on time, 5 days in advance, 5 minutes in advance.
I'm an eternal optimist, and I'm sure all systems will be go when heads of states will arrive. Mr. Klein, you've moved to the right.
Well, that's my normal direction. But anyway, what do you have a current head count on the number of heads of state and leaders of government that will be attending the climate change summit?
At this point, we have well over 100 heads of states and governments that are expected to attend the climate change summit. Sir. I have no comment on the particular case, but I will say that the United Nations, and we've always stood for the freedom of the press and freedom of expression as enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Matthew. No, the other Matthew. Yeah. We're still on round one.
The other Matthew. All right. Hi. There's a report in the New York Times saying that Prime Minister Abe sent a letter encouraging Japanese war dead to be honored. Does the Secretary General have a response to that?
No, I have no particular comment on that. Matthew, and then we'll go.
Sure. I wanted to ask, at the you started by mentioning this, the Sahel presidential statement, mm-hmm. and I guess I wanted adopted by the Security Council today. Mm-hmm. And in that, Chad at the stakeout, the permanent representative of Chad, acknowledged that they'd wish that the office of the special envoy not be in Dakar, Senegal, but be in fact in one of the G5 countries. And I know that some of the P3 big contributing countries also said that they didn't want the position upgraded to USG as Chad and the G5 countries requested, because they said the Secretary General had said that this is an assistant Secretary General position. So since the Secretariat's views on both matters were cited in the negotiation of the presidential statement, what's the rationale? Why shouldn't an office about the Sahel be located in one of the five countries of the Sahel, and why shouldn't the envoy, who's supposed to interface with heads of state of the five countries, be an undersecretary general? Can you explain?
I think, you know, the choice of the location obviously has to do with what is most efficient in terms of logistics and getting people in and out of the region. I'm not sure too much should be read into it. As for the level, it was the level that was deemed appropriate. Karim, and then Ms. Jabadi.
Just to follow up on UNAMID, on July 2nd, you said that the review was to be completed within 1 month. So are we to understand that you're late?
Well, that would be probably a conclusion that anyone could make. So let me get you an update. Mr. Abadi.
Thank you, Stefan. As you know, the president of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, is being investigated in Paris regarding some financial issues. She is not expected to resign. Does this issue weaken her position, her international position as IMF president?
I think my understanding is that she's returning, and we'll discuss that with the board of the IMF, and it is up to the board of the IMF to make that decision. Yes.
Thank you, Stefan. Is there an update on the current situation of the Yazidis in Sinjar?
Of the what? Sorry? I can't hear your question.
Yazidis.
No, sorry, I have no. We've asked, in fact, our colleagues who are in northern Iraq for an update, so hopefully we'll get something before the end of the week. We've also trying to get a briefing into here from a senior humanitarian official in Erbil. Mr. Lee.
Sure. I wanted to ask about Ebola and also totally separately about Sri Lanka. On Ebola, I know that you had this statement about air travel, mm-hmm. and I wanted to ask you to apply it to a specific case. The French government has recommended that Air France temporarily suspend its flights to Monrovia, Liberia, and Air France has already agreed to now suspend its flights to Freetown, Sierra Leone. And how does this relate to the recommendations the UN has given?
You know, whether it's Air France, we've seen, I think, other airlines, British Airways and others, shutting down flights. Now, we understand that these airlines, you know, are free to make the decisions they feel appropriate. From our end, I think, as Dr. Nabarro has said clearly, this only adds to the isolation of the countries, and it hinders the ability of the UN and the humanitarian community to send in experts and other supplies that may be needed. I think, as we've said here, the risk of infection, of casual infection, is extremely low. You are infected with Ebola, with contact with bodily fluid of someone who is already showing the symptoms. So we would ask, we've asked private companies, airlines, to continue to fly, to continue to deliver food. Isolating these countries can only exacerbate a difficult situation.
And if you don't mind, on Sri Lanka, I wanted to ask, as you know, there's this panel of inquiry set up by the Human Rights Council, mm-hmm. but there's an open letter published by groups in Sri Lanka and also by Amnesty International mm-hmm. On the website of the International Commission of Jurists calling on the UN system as a whole mm-hmm. to provide protection to the people that will testify, because given statements by the government of Sri Lanka, for example, mm-hmm. that they won't let the inspectors in, that no one should cooperate. There's a big concern of people being retaliated against or worse for cooperating. So I wanted to know, is there any precedent for the UN mm-hmm. the UN system, and I know that you're going to say ask the security, but given the Secretary General's visit there and otherwise, is there any precedent for the UN in soliciting information about possible war crimes, providing protection for information for people that come forward, and how might it apply?
It's a good question. I think we'd have to look back at the historical record of the various investigations, human rights investigations the UN has done. We can help you in that regard. Mr. Avni.
Just a quick follow-up on the Yazidi question. Could you also help ask to add to your query a question about the Turkmen situation? As
yes,
well.
I mean, the situation of the Turkmen Shia and Afrili is one that we've expressed concern, and we will try to get an update on as well. Yes, ma'am.
On Saudi Arabia, is there an update about the trial of Sheikh al-Shamiri?
No, there's not. All right, yes. Please turn on your microphone. Thank you. Okay. There you go.
You may already have addressed this. There now it reports that the U.S. is considering airstrikes on Syria. What is the reaction of the Secretary General?
I addressed that yesterday.
Oh.
This just in. Okay. Excellent. Mr. Mitri is at the stakeout very shortly, and he will be happy to see you all.